this is a two-in-one episode of Cut the Clutter. We are talking about a very big turning point in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I would say probably the biggest turning point since the invasion began more than 7 months ago. And second, also maybe a little bit more briefly, about the Congress Party, the state of the Congress Party. And thereby, I might even tell you a story that you've been wanting to hear for a long time. I think I had teased it at some point on how Pranab Mukherjee had been able to run circles around Mrs. Gandhi, that is Sonia Gandhi, in around 2010-2012, but essentially in 2012, when time came to choose the party's next presidential candidate. So we'll look at both. That's the reason, two in one. First of all, Ukraine. Now, the big turning point, what have the big turning points been so far? First, the big one, Russian forces getting so close to Kiev, and Russian commandos, big commando force, the best of the Russian armed forces, landing up in airport called Hostomel, airbase called Hostomel, not far from Kiev, seizing it so that this could then become the staging base for them to completely dismantle the Zelensky government. And the expectation was that Zelensky would run away like Ghani in Afghanistan, but that didn't happen. And we know that the Ukrainians then turned things around. So that was the second turning point, when Ukrainians routed those forces and the Russians withdrew. Second time, Russians came back, now more organized, in a grinding war to take more territory. And in that process, they took almost a lot of Donetsk and Luhansk, or what is the Donbass region. They also took the important city of Mariupol, which is also on the banks of the Black Sea. So that was the second phase. Third phase then began when the Ukrainians countered. Now, you will tell me that a lot of things happen in between, but I'm just giving you a quick recap, as my late friend Vinod Dua would say in his discussions that he co-hosted with Pranoy Roy. So I'm giving you a quick recap. The next big turning point was the sizable Ukrainian counter. And that sizable Ukrainian counter then brought Ukrainian forces into Russian-controlled territory and then drove them away from many important centers south of Kharkiv, if you see on the map, including the city of Izium and many others. And that's where Ukrainians took a large number of Russian troops prisoner. And in exchange for that, Ukrainians were also able to get back some of their favored troops from Azovstal garrison. These were the troops who were fighting in the basement of the Azovstal steel plant garrison in Mariupol. So they got many of those back, and you can see some pictures as I'm speaking on my screen. So that was the next turning point. Now, the Ukrainians were building pressure on the town of Kherson. Kherson is way south, but again very close to Black Sea. And if Ukrainians get Kherson, which is the other side of the Dnieper River, right? Usually, you would see that in warfare, a river becomes a dividing line. So Russians had taken most of the territory, say, east of the Dnieper River, and Ukrainians were strong on the other side. Kherson is the only Russian foothold of any size west of the Dnieper River, the other side of the river. If the Ukrainians take that, one, they will rationalize the front. Second, they will get then one more route to Black Sea and one more place of proximity, so say to the Crimean region, so they can harass Russian garrisons and Russian installations in the Crimean region. Crimea, as we know, Russia had occupied in 2014 and had then held a referendum and had annexed it, saying it's a part of our country. So while the focus was there, it was evident that Ukrainian pressure was also rising in a region further south of Izium. Again, see the map. Further south of Izium. And so they were getting into the Russian occupation armed forces underbelly. As they were getting into Izium, the gap between, say the south and the north was closing in terms of the expansion of the Ukrainian counterattack, and they were now surrounding the city of Lyman. The city of Lyman is not quite as big as some of the others. It still it has about 20,000-30,000 people, which even by European standards is not a big city, but it's very crucial. Because if the Ukrainians that take that city, which they seemed poised to do, because already we are seeing unconfirmed videos, but usually from sources which have turned out to be correct, of a lot of the Russians fleeing Lyman. And it seems that the only route that's left for Russian forces to escape from Lyman, that's in the line of fire of long-range Ukrainian artillery, so they can inflict a lot of casualties there. So Lyman came under pressure, and it is at that time that Putin has played this big move, which is now what I call the biggest turning point so far in the war. What has he done? He's held referendums or referenda in the places he's occupied. Now Donetsk and Luhansk, he'd say, don't worry, because he had already, remember, in February, he had proclaimed them, he had recognized those as sovereign republics. So he'd say, those are sovereign republics anyway, and they've decided to merge with Russia. At the same time now, the area of Zaporizhia, that's where the big nuclear plant is, and there are lots of controversies about that nuclear plant, about who's shelling it and the nuclear dangers, and IAEA inspectors have been there. So the Zaporizhia area and also the Kherson area, which the Ukrainians are now targeting, and which Putin would loathe to lose, because Kherson, since the war started, Kherson is the only regional capital that Russian forces have captured. Now, if that falls back to the Ukrainians, it's a big loss of face. So partly also because it will be a double loss of face. Lyman itself is bad enough. Kherson will be really a crippling loss of face. So he's now said that I've held referendums in Kherson and Zaporizhia region. So Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, they've all voted to merge with Russia. So what has he done? He issued a decree on Thursday, that is yesterday as I record this. In that decree, he said that Zaporizhia and Kherson, I recognize their state sovereignty and independence. And then because they are independent sovereign states and they've held a referendum whereby the majority of 98%, 97%, look who's counting, that's a more important thing. So with those majorities, those have decided to join Russia. So I am accepting them as parts of Russia. Now, what happens when he says, I'm accepting them as a part of Russia? Once they become Russian territory, then under Russian law, a very important thing happens. And this is Russian law or the Russian constitution as it stands after Putin's amendments. After Putin's recent amendments into Russian constitution, the constitution says that in future that no Russian ruler ever will be able to trade any territories that Russia calls its own, which means you cannot, unless you change the constitution, you cannot negotiate on these territories, which means once he merges Luhansk, Donetsk, that's the entire Donbass region, and Zaporizhia and Kherson, once he merges all of that into Russia, no Russian ruler, including Putin himself, can tomorrow negotiate on giving this away or any part of it away back to Ukraine. The second important thing is that once this becomes part of the Russian territory, then Russia will reserve constitutionally and in terms of their own laws and politics, the right to defend them, even if that means having to use nuclear weapons. So Putin has made some statements in the recent past about using weapons that NATO can't imagine. And there have been many hints about nuclear weapons. But once he says, these are my territories, and any effort to gain any of my territories, Russia's territories, will get a nuclear response. That will raise the stakes, not just for Ukraine, but all its backers. Do they then take the nuclear risk? Do they dismiss it as a bluff by Putin? Or do they call his bluff and say, all right, go ahead, make my day. You want to use the nukes? Obviously, he'll not use some high megatonnage nukes. He'll use smaller tactical nukes, particularly in areas where Ukrainian armed forces are concentrated, but they will then be a response. The response, even if it's not nuclear, it will have to be substantive enough, like NATO air power getting involved in attacking Russian facilities or Russian installations inside. So you are then looking at a qualitatively different level of escalation. And that's the reason I say that this turning point is the most important one in the war so far, because Putin knows that he's losing on the ground. If he's losing on the ground, he controlled about 20% of Ukraine's territory. That's nearly 100,000 square kilometers. Now he's left with about 85,000-90,000 square kilometers. He's now saying that all of this is mine, but I also reserve the right to capture some of the Donetsk region or Donbas region, which is still not in my occupation. But if the other side tries to take any of this territory from me right now, and effectively that would apply then to Lyman and to Kherson as well, then I reserve the right to use nuclear weapons because I'm only defending my own territory. So to that extent, this has become very complicated. Now, this is quite obvious that many people in Russia are not enthused by this, because he ordered a generalized mobilization, which means any adult in a particular age group who's had any military training, and a lot of people in Russia have had military training in the past or anything to do with military, can be called up now, or should be called up in most places, will be called up to join the war effort. And that's got a lot of people running away. And you've seen these pictures and videos of 18-kilometer, 28-kilometer long traffic jams on Russia's border, say with Finland, Georgia, places like that, Belarus. Although Belarus is now making its own noises, Lukashenko, the ruler of Belarus, is now saying that he might join the war, that his Sukhoi 24s are ready and they can carry tactical nuclear weapons, and also he will raise an army of lakh and 20,000, etc., etc. But a lot of the Russians have been fleeing, particularly Russian men have been fleeing. So the basic thing all these jokes are saying is that, look, all of us have seen people fleeing their country because it's been invaded by another country, by a hostile country. But it's the first time we are seeing people fleeing a country because their country has invaded another country. So as we talk, more than 200,000 Russians seem to have left. And Putin, in his speech on Thursday, after he signed his decrees, recognizing the sovereignty of Zaporizhia and Kherson, after that, in his speech, he said that mistakes have been made in this mobilization, and we should reflect on those mistakes and try and correct them and not repeat them going ahead. So that's a big change right now. In sum, with these decrees and with this annexation, these occupied territories effectively acquire the Russian nuclear umbrella. So we'll have to see over the next couple of days what goes on. Does Ukraine keep pushing towards Lyman and Kherson, etc.? And if Russians find it difficult to hold their ground in these places, how do the Russians respond? Chances are they will respond very, very viciously. And we've seen some of that in these gas pipeline explosions, Nord Stream 1 and 2. Now, these are deep gas pipelines, thick walls, cemented, very, very strong. You need a lot of technology, a lot of naval power skills to get down there and blow these up. And these are explosions are so big. In one case, the bubble that this leaking gas has created is like a football field, like 9 football field diameter, 900 meters. In another place, it's 200 meters. So all of these, who's done it? Your guess is as good as mine. Although the Norwegians and the others are now saying that, look, we've seen some Russian naval assets in the vicinity and we are now strengthening our security. But Russians, they have a sense of humor. They've said that this is an act of terrorism. Thank you. This is an act of terrorism, act of terrorist backed by a state. So this is a state-supported terrorist act. And who could have done it? They are saying only the Americans could have done it, because one, their security forces and intelligence has a pretty good eye on this area. Who knows better than them what's happening here? And second, the Americans commercially benefit, because if this gas supply stops, then Americans get to sell their liquefied natural gas. Obviously, I don't think many people are buying this. Right now, we can see the UN Secretary General is holding an unscheduled press conference, and he's going to be warning Russia. Everybody has said, every other country has said, Western country, that we don't recognize this. These are sham referendums. Even other countries, India, China, which may be a little bit more nuanced in their view on this situation, are not going to support this annexation. And that's why this war has now reached a new and a very dangerous phase. Now, Ashok Gehlot, we don't exactly know what will happen, whether he will hold his chief minister's position or not. But first of all, he has escaped the responsibility of being on the hot seat as Congress president, because everybody knows Congress president will just be the driver of a bus in a convoy, that is, or the lead bus in a convoy that is led by another commander, another captain, and that is the Gandhi family. So he escaped that, and he let Mrs. Gandhi know, he outmaneuvered her into a situation whereby he would be able to give up the presidential election but hold on to his chief minister's position. So what has he done? First of all, he's shown up to his party that presidential position that the Congress party needs means nothing. You don't control anything. This is what I would normally have described as admiral of the Royal Nepalese Navy. There is no water and there are no ships. So in this case, you don't control any of the party, any troops. You don't decide anything. You don't control any territory. So what's the point of being the admiral of the Royal Nepalese Navy? So that's one. But the important thing is done is he's shown up the Gandhi family. He's shown up the Gandhi family for being much weaker than they used to be. And he has said, look, your writ no longer runs. Now, they may deny him the chief ministership of Rajasthan. But if that is done, then he will undermine his successor if successor is not of his choice, particularly if the successor is Sachin Pilot, in which case Rajasthan would be headed the way of Punjab. We know what happened in Punjab. Gandhis did not like Amrinder Singh. They wanted him to go. Amrinder Singh thumbed his nose at them. They forced him to go. They wanted to put Sidhu there. They were not able to put Sidhu there because their MLAs would not have agreed, and Amrinder also played his games. So they had to put in Chenny there. Now you know what's happened. Sidhu is in jail. Chenny is in exile. Nobody knows where he is. And Amrinder is in the BJP. So something like that could happen in Rajasthan. In the process, Ashok Gehlot has shown the Congress party, high command, or the dynasty, that they are not, they are a pale shadow of what they used to be. And this has happened in the past. The last time it happened, and the leader who first broke this myth that never defy the Gandhi family was Pranab Mukherjee. Between 2010 and 2012, first of all, he always wanted the finance ministry. If he could not get the prime ministership, he had a grievance that after Indira Gandhi's assassination, he was not made the prime minister. It was Rajiv who was made the prime minister, and through sort of backroom dealings, without even the basic decency or formality of going to the party's bodies, that is the parliamentary board, CWC, etc. In fact, in the second volume of his autobiography, he mentioned that this decision was made in All India Institute of Medical Sciences, as people were yet to collect Mrs. Gandhi's body, and this was done between P.C. Alexander and others, backroom people, Arun Nehru and others, backroom people around Mrs. Gandhi without any reference to party bodies. In that book, he said how history will, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, I leave it to historians to judge in the future. So you knew what he was saying, Akalmand ko ishara kafi hai. Next time, when he wanted to be president, it was evident that Mrs. Gandhi's preference for presidential candidate for the Congress party was not Pranab Mukherjee. It was Hamid Ansari, who was then vice president. Now, I cannot say it for sure, but in the capital, in Latin study, the scuttlebutt was that Mrs. Gandhi had committed that nomination to him, but Pranab Mukherjee was going to have none of it. So he reached out to Mulayam Singh Yadav on his own using his contacts. He reached out to Mamata Banerjee and her people. Mamata Banerjee at one point had even come around to suggesting to sort of suggesting even APJ Kalam or even Somnath Chatterjee for that matter. But he got around to that, and he also reached out to the BJP. He reached out to the BJP. Some of those meetings were recorded. He had his friendship with MJ Akbar, who was then a key figure very close to the BJP, and others. And he then let Mrs. Gandhi know, Sonia Gandhi know, that if he wasn't to be her nominee, what happens if he decides to contest on his own? And what happens if he contests and many of these UPA allies, particularly Mulayam and some others, vote for him, and then maybe the BJP decides to support him, or some do, and maybe that leads to a split in the Congress party as well. And we know what had happened with the Congress party in 1969. Congress party had its official candidate, Sanjeeva Reddy. Indira Gandhi, who had been thrown out by the original Congress party, she put up V.V. Giri as her candidate. And then there was cross-voting, and her candidate got elected. In the process, the original Congress just went into history. They just became irrelevant. So that is the threat, if I understand correctly, that he gave to the leadership of the Congress party, mainly the dynasty. So many such figures have risen as the dynasty has weakened. And that's why almost anybody in the Congress who has any presence, any stature, today feels it that they can challenge the high command, and they can work to their own benefit, even if it means undermining the interests of the party. So in English language, you say fence eating the garden, right? In Urdu, you might say that familiar line is ghar ko aag lagi, is ghar ke chiragon se, that this house was set on fire by lamps lit by residents of this house to light their house, but this was set on fire by the same lamps. Or maybe Anand Bakshi, when he wrote Chingari Koi Bhadke for Amar Prem in 1972, the Sharmila Tagore, Rajesh Khanna starrer, maybe he meant something like this when he said, or maybe what he said there describes this situation with the Congress party. So I'll quote just one stanza from that song, Chingari Koi Bhadke To Saban Use Bujhaye. And here it goes. Humse mat poochho kaise mandir toota sapno ka, लोगों की बात नहीं है ये किस्सा है अपनों का कोई दुश्मन ठेस लगाए तो मीत जिया बहलाए दैट मीन्स इफ एन एनिमी कॉजेज यू एनी हर्ट देन इट्स योर फ्रेंड हु विल अप्लाई बाम ऑन इट मन मीत जो घाव लगाए उसे कौन मिटाए बट व्हाट इफ योर क्लोजेस्ट फ्रेंड योर लॉयलिस्ट स्टार्ट्स इन्फ्लिक्टिंग वुंड्स ऑन यू हु इज गोइंग टू हेल्प यू हील दोस दैट इज द स्टेट ऑफ द कांग्रेस पार्टी This song, Anand Bakshi, could pretty much have written to describe today's condition of the Congress party.